I'm Mike Hudak, Director of Public Lands Without Livestock and author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. Please see the book's website, westernturfwars.com, for information about the book. I've been asked to speak about the harms to our environment that result from ranching on public lands. Many people are unfamiliar with the term public lands ranching. When they think of public lands in the United States, they think of national parks, such as Yellowstone, Yosemite, and Grand Canyon. Ranching has not been allowed on these and most other national park lands for many years. But there are other types of federal lands where ranching continues to this day. The United States Forest Service has, since 1905, managed the grazing of livestock on much of its lands, particularly in the western United States. These lands are mostly what are called national forests. But on the Great Plains, there are also some national grasslands. About 97 million acres of Forest Service lands are currently used to graze livestock. Another federal agency, the Bureau of Land Management, known as the BLM, manages an even larger area of land for ranching, about 163 million acres. While Forest Service lands are typically upland forests, except for those Midwestern grasslands that I mentioned, BLM lands are usually of lower elevation and receive little precipitation. Large areas of these lands are classified as deserts, such as the Mojave, the Sonoran, and the Great Basin. Arid lands are particularly vulnerable to damage caused by the grazing of cattle. Desert grasses are poorly adapted to intense herbivory, and so the long-term grazing of cattle has led to their extirpation. Without the stabilizing presence of these grasses, topsoil has eroded away. Together, these changes have opened the way for the spread of weeds. In this way, the grazing of livestock has significantly degraded the habitat for many species of wildlife that include reptiles, mammals, and ground-nesting birds. Livestock grazing along desert streams has led to similar degradation. Once grasses and other streamside plants have been grazed to the ground, erosion of the stream banks produces wider, shallower streams that are laden with silt. A shallow stream follows more closely the temperature of its surroundings. And in a hot desert, that means increased daytime water temperatures. Higher water temperatures will deprive fish of oxygen. Really high temperatures will be lethal. And that silt in the water can clog fish gills and smother fish eggs. Cattle even consume the shoots of streamside trees, such as willow and alder. Then, years later, when mature trees die off, there are no replacements. Without trees to shade the stream, daytime water temperatures of shallow streams increase still further. And it's not only fish that are harmed by the absence of these trees. So are birds that nest and perch in them. Even upland forests suffer harmful alterations to their structure and fire dynamics as a result of cattle grazing. By removing the forest grasses that carry low-intensity fires, many more young trees survive, eventually creating a much denser forest, and one where there is greater competition for nutrients and moisture. During drought, many of these trees will outright die, or become more susceptible to attack by insects, which will also increase tree mortality. Such a forest contains a lot more dead wood than an ungrazed forest, making it much more prone to catastrophic fire after a lightning strike. These livestock-induced environmental degradations have had disastrous consequences for native wildlife. Indeed, more than 150 wildlife species are so imperiled that they've been federally listed as threatened or endangered, are candidates for listing, or have been petitioned for listing. And when we're talking about listing a species as endangered, we're talking about that species being at risk of extinction within the near future. Besides these species that are in greatest jeopardy, more than 160 additional wildlife species are also harmed by habitat degradations caused by ranching. Fortunately, these species are not yet so imperiled as to warrant federal listing. One might wonder why the federal agencies, such as the Forest Service and the BLM, allow the livestock under their management to imperil wildlife. A few years ago, when I was conducting research for my book Western Turf Wars, I interviewed people who spoke about the factors that influence the actions of these agencies. One of the people with whom I spoke is Steve Johnson, a former Southwestern field representative for the organization Defenders of Wildlife. Here's what Johnson said to me. Reducing cattle numbers on public lands was a primary goal for many of us in the environmental community in the 1970s, but it was almost impossible to do. And I realized why when I discovered permit value. It was in the late 70s, 78, I believe. A banker was at a symposium I was attending in Texas. I was there to give presentations about grazing numbers and perhaps animal damage control. But he was talking to me privately about how many of the ranchers were financed by his bank, which would actually loan money to a rancher based on the numbers of cattle he had under federal permit. Not on the value of the private land on which the ranch house stood, but on the numbers of cattle that could be grazed on federal lands. Well, that was a whole new thing to me. I suddenly realized that if you had a 400-cow ranch, and you had a loan based on 400 cows, then any attempt to reduce the numbers of cattle that you had would not only affect the rancher and his ability to pay it back, but the bank would be affected too, because its loan would be at risk. And this was another powerful element in the political system that would fight any reductions of cattle for the most fundamental of reasons. It also helped to explain why U.S. senators often intervened in BLM and Forest Service grazing decisions, and why so many agency employees were transferred. I knew that ranches were financed, but I had always thought that the main value of a ranch was in the private land, the base property. Well, I've discovered since then that base property can be nothing more than water. If you have a well that produces water, that's base property to the BLM, and sometimes to the Forest Service. You don't even have to own any place to put a house on. So learning about permit value explained a lot of things I didn't understand before about the difficulty of the issue. So that's what Johnson said to me. And you see from his remarks that the federal agencies can be under tremendous pressure from banks and from politicians who have budgetary control over these agencies. Even if a member of these agencies wants to change the management of cattle to protect wildlife, they may not be able to do it and still keep their job. Let's look at an actual situation where permit value became a factor in the management of a Forest Service grazing allotment. Mike Sauber and his partner, in the 1990s, ran an environmental organization called Gila Watch in Silver City, New Mexico. Here's what he said. When a rancher wants to get a permit to graze federal public land, a privilege, not a right, as so many newspapers and media often call it, a rancher buys a base property. And for that base property, he's paying an inflated amount. The difference between what the base property costs, the true value of the base property, and that inflated value is based on the number of cattle that he can run on his adjacent federal allotment, among other things. Basically, a bank loaning money for this has no security except for the ability of a rancher to run cattle on his public land allotment. If the Forest Service attempts to reduce numbers of cattle for resource protection, that's when the banks really freak out, because the permittee will no longer have the ability to make sufficient payments to the bank. There is a memorandum of understanding between the Forest Service and the banking industry that allows the Forest Service to act as an escrow agent, holding the grazing permit for the bank and the permittee until it is paid in full. If the permittee defaults on the loan, the Forest Service is to give the bank another chance at reselling the base property with the permit attached to it, so the bank won't lose out on the deal. In the case we were dealing with, the former permittee on the Diamond Bar had gone bankrupt. The Federal Intermediate Credit Bank of Texas, that held the mortgage on the base property with the permit attached to it, then sold it to the Laneys. The Forest Service was in the process at that time of lowering the allowable number of grazing cattle on the allotment from 1,188 down to 833. There was a letter to the Forest Service from the bank that threatened to play hardball if the numbers were reduced. We decided to investigate the bank that held the mortgage on the Laney's grazing permit. With the money they raised, they donated to many congressmen and senators, amongst them a significant amount to Senator Domenici, and even some to Democratic Senator Jeff Bingaman, also from New Mexico. This is why we have such difficulty getting good, honest management of our federal lands. Senator Domenici, who was the chair of the Budget Committee in the U.S. Senate at that time, held a lot of sway over decisions on the Forest Service and utilized his power to the detriment of wilderness and wildlife values. People typically assume that ranchers have a lot of power, but it's not really true. It's the banks holding the estimated $2 billion that's loaned out on grazing permits on western public lands that have power. Our public lands are being used as collateral for bank loans. Our wilderness areas, archaeological sites, watersheds, wildlife habitat is being mortgaged, used as collateral for bank loans of ranchers that are buying base properties with grazing permits attached to them. That concludes the remarks by Mike Sauber. Based on the statements of Johnson and Sauber, it is not surprising that the federal agencies favor the ranchers and the banks rather than wildlife. Wildlife simply has less political clout. The agency's willingness to degrade and even destroy the land under their management brings to mind a statement by Walter Loudermilk from his report titled Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years. Loudermilk, a researcher for the Soil Conservation Service in the 1930s, wrote this report after extensive travel through countries of the Middle East and Mediterranean region. Here's what Loudermilk wrote. Land, after all, is not an economic commodity. It is an integral part of the nation, even as its people are, and requires protection by the individual owner and the nation as well. End of quote. I'll leave you with a statement made to me by yet another person who I interviewed for my book Western Turf Wars. Charmaine Whiteface is a Lakota activist from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Speaking about impacts of cattle ranching on her own region, Whiteface had this to say. There need to be studies on what has disappeared since Lewis and Clark came here. Go back and read those Lewis and Clark diaries. Look at the diversity of animals, plants, insects, birds that were here when they came up the Missouri River. And look at it now, what's left. A minuscule amount compared to what they originally saw. I see it from a different perspective, because it wasn't just the plants and animals that disappeared. It was my people, too. My ancestors. So if anything is to be saved, we've got to get away from just looking at the dollar. You can't eat the dollar when there's no food, and can't breathe it when there's no air, can't drink it when there's no water.